In a polarized political age, we want to seek the good of our neighbors, engage in politics in a distinctly Christian way, and work together to be salt and light in our local communities, in our states, and in our nation. We invite you to join us at the Southern Baptist Convention annual meeting in Indianapolis for a lunch conversation with Vice President Mike Pence and ERLC President Brent Leatherwood on Tuesday, June 11th. They'll discuss Vice President Pence's journey into politics, how pastors can partner with elected officials, and how we all can engage with hope in the public square. Space is limited, so register online today at erlc.com/events to reserve your seat for Serving in the Public Square, a conversation with Vice President Mike Pence and Brent Leatherwood.
You're listening to the ERLC podcast.
Are you muted?
I was. Sorry.
Hello, and welcome back to this week's episode of the ERLC podcast, where every week we are talking about our work here at the ERLC and focusing on what Christians need to know about the things going on in the world. I'm Josh Wester, and with me on the podcast today, as always, are my co-host, Lindsay Nicolay.
Hello from Nashville, where it is way too hot to be fall. 80 degrees is not okay in late October.
And I'll say hello from me, and given my typical half glass full disposition, I am thankful for the warm weather that we are having here.
Your glass is half full if it's warm. If it was cold outside, you'd be like, ah, it's the end of the world.
Well, that's fine. I mean, when the end of the world comes, it's going to be because, you know, we're freezing.
So I think that every week now, the intro to the podcast is turning into people trying to understand how Brent loves Christmas music and Christmas and hates winter and cold. Stay tuned for more on this story.
Because I don't like death, because death is terrible, and that's what winter signifies.
Good grief.
Yes. Man, there's some Narnian themes going on there. Always winter, never Christmas. So anyway, so we can get into the show. Later in the show, we're excited to talk to a special guest, Jennifer Marshall Patterson, who has been a friend and partner with the ERLC for many years. And we're excited to talk to her. But Lindsay, so that we can get into the podcast and off of Christmas, tell us what the ERLC has been talking about this week.
Well, I don't necessarily want to get off of the topic of Christmas, but since we don't have any Christmas pieces yet, then I will. So we've got a lot of great content at ERLC.com this week. And these three that I'm going to talk about are just a little taste of what we're featuring. So the first is by Benjamin Quinn, and it's another addition to our primer series where we're highlighting books that are pivotal in helping us understand different aspects and issues when it comes to Christian ethics. Dr. Quinn's piece is, How Does My Faith in Jesus Connect with My Work Life? Every kind of work is a sacred calling. And I thought this was really good because honestly, work doesn't always feel sacred, and work doesn't always feel like a gift. And I have talked to people who are not in vocational ministry per se, and they feel like they're not doing enough with their lives to serve the Lord, which is could not be further from the truth. So I appreciated Benjamin Quinn's take here. He was sharing from the book by Jean E. Veith, and it's called God at Work. And he just extols this book and says just how pivotal it's been for him and how easy it is to read and just how helpful it was. So one of his quotes was this: the doctrine of vocation, though it has to do with human work, is essentially about God's work and how God works in and through our lives. And so I thought that was a helpful take because we get too focused on ourselves and what we're doing when really we should be focused on the Lord and looking at how he's at work in us and those around us.
Yeah, I was actually the one that solicited this piece. I've taken classes with Dr. Quinn at Southeastern, and he is just incredible, and he has really important things to say on the subject of faith and work. And if you're not familiar with the work of Jean Veith, like, this is a really great introduction to a critical thinker in this area that is also just very accessible. And so I couldn't commend this article or this book any more strongly.
Josh, was that a humble brag? Did you need to let our listeners know that you—
I was actually just trying to show my particular connection to the piece, but sure, if it was a humble brag.
Okay,
I'm glad
sure,
Benjamin Quinn. He's a real boss, and he's actually an Augustine scholar, and that is what I've learned from him the most. But in any case, sorry for the humble brag.
No, it's okay. So we also wanted to highlight that this month is Pastor Appreciation Month, and our pastors have walked through a particularly hard time this season with COVID, of course, and just all the decisions that they are facing. So our former intern, Isaac Whitney, wrote a piece just thanking publicly his pastor for the work that he's done, for how he served his church. And of course, this could apply to so many pastors across the board. And it's called Why I'm Thankful for My Pastor's Leadership During COVID. And we actually, some of us know his pastor. His name's Raymond Johnson in Pennsylvania. And I just thought it was such a thoughtful piece. I hope that it encourages other pastors to know that their work is not going unseen. I hope it encourages us as readers and as lay people at the church to make sure that we are vocally thanking our pastors for the hard work that we're doing, even when we disagree, because of course we're sinners, we're humans, we're going to disagree with one another. But even in the midst of those disagreements, Paul tells us that it's our job to respect those who are put in leadership and to esteem them because of their work that they're doing on our behalf. So we were really thankful for this piece and want to encourage you to go tell your pastors thank you.
Yeah, this has been a season of stress in all parts of society, but particularly on our churches and pastors just trying to navigate folks that are isolated and distanced and then gathering us back together. This is certainly a time to express appreciation for our pastors that in normal times have a role to play that is unimaginably difficult at times. And I can't even appreciate how difficult it's been for my own pastor. And so we should take a moment to express our appreciation and thanks for what they do.
Yes, which is convicting because I have yet to do that this month. And it shouldn't just take me a particular month to do that. I need to apply this, what we are running on ERLC. And finally, we want to highlight, with just a little over a week left until our election here in the U.S., we felt as an organization it's important to highlight civility, which is essentially, as our president here at the ERLC, Russell Moore, says, is convictional kindness. Treating other people with kindness in the public square, treating our neighbors with kindness, treating them with respect, treating them with the dignity that they deserve. So we've put together a civility toolkit, which will actually be linked to in this article. But our friend Daryl Crouch was really instrumental in putting this together, and we have shared an excerpt from it. And it's titled, How Do We Live for the Kingdom in This Contentious Moment? And what Daryl does here is he takes a passage from Dr. Moore's book, Onward, and he just reminds us that as Christians, we're citizens of this world, but ultimately our highest allegiance is as citizens of Jesus's kingdom, that we have a king that we're looking to who lays out for us and empowers us to live the way that he has designed. And actually, it's a way that's designed for human flourishing. And so it's just an encouragement to not get caught up in all of the hateful partisan politics that are happening currently in our culture, but instead to live as those who are different, who have a different kingdom that we're looking forward to, who have a different calling, who have a different king, and to point those around us to that king, because we are called to be ambassadors for Christ.
Yeah, you know what's so great about this piece, Lindsay, is the fact that Daryl is not just some kind of political prognosticator. He's not some person sitting on the sidelines. He's a local church pastor who is thinking through how to lead his church to embody Christ-likeness. And in this case, how we're talking about how to, in the middle of a polarized and contentious time, to be this salt and light that Jesus calls us to be. And so that for me is why his voice is so important. And he was, as you mentioned, instrumental. He's really the creative force behind the church civility toolkit that we have created. And so anyway, really grateful for Daryl and for this piece, because these are things that Christians need to be thinking about right now.
Yeah. In your words, Josh, that's exactly right. I totally agree with you. Daryl is the one to write this, because he is the real deal, and he's there living this out in the midst of his community in some encouraging ways. So that's just a little smattering of the things that we have going on at ERLC.com. We have some videos, we have some podcasts, we have other articles there that we're featuring, but we wanted to make you particularly aware of those three. Want to encourage you to check out our site. That's your look at what's happening at erlc.com.
Hey, thanks so much for that rundown, Lindsay. And Brent, that takes us to you in the culture section. So tell us what's going on.
That's right. It was another fast-paced week in culture. So let's start with something that actually took place after we recorded this. So we are speaking into the future, in a sense. So the final debate took place on Thursday night after we recorded this, between President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden. We are going to link to kind of an explainer, what to look for, from the Wall Street Journal, but you'll get to see if what they told us to look out for actually happened. So the debate will likely be the last time that these two men will appear before such a large audience of American television viewers during the campaign, writes the Wall Street Journal. Millions of people have already cast their ballots, and others are preparing to vote in person or by mail. Both Donald Trump and Joe Biden will meet here in Nashville, or, because we're recording this and releasing it afterwards, they met in Nashville at Belmont University. And this is the second time that Belmont has hosted a presidential debate. Some folks may remember that back in 2008, they hosted the debate between President Obama and former U.S. Senator John McCain. So there's a little bit of presidential trivia, which I know our audience is always tuning in for here at the ERLC podcast.
I can say this. I've seen the pictures, and it looks gorgeous. At least the outside of Belmont does. It's definitely a beautiful location for a debate.
That's right.
Let's hope that it's a beautiful debate.
It'll be a tremendous debate.
Yeah, I mean, I feel pretty like I'm standing on safe ground to say this. There's nowhere to go but up. So I think, you know, my expectations are for a slightly better outcome than we saw the last time.
We shall see. So you're on the record, Josh, raising expectations.
Yes.
In this.
Your glass, I'm just following the glass half full perspective that you told us to embrace at the beginning.
That's right. And after this podcast drops, we will be one day closer to Christmas, which is another way of looking with a glass half full perspective.
It will also be cooler outside this weekend.
Well, there you go. Lindsay, see, we're all just coming together here on the ERLC podcast. All right, so moving on from there to a report from the Washington Post. So early voting counts suggest a record level of civic participation before Election Day. The tens of millions of ballots already cast show highly enthusiastic voters are making sure their votes are counted amidst the COVID-19 pandemic. Voting before Election Day has been expanded this year because of the coronavirus, an option that more than 60% of registered voters want, according to a Washington Post University of Maryland poll from September. More voters than ever can vote by mail this election. While some Western states have long conducted their elections by mail, others, such as New Hampshire, are allowing voters to cast ballots by mail for the first time. So as we went on air, I went and looked. We are now up to approximately 43 million votes being cast in this election already during this early voting period. That is an astronomical number that we've never seen before.
We're seeing so many people come out during early voting, and not just like during early voting, but at the very beginning of this process to go ahead and make sure that their vote gets counted. I was having a conversation with a friend this week, and I was just reflecting on how interesting it is that so many of us have different like election day traditions. Like I'm traditionally like an early voter, but he was talking about how he always votes on election day because he likes to be a part of, he just likes that feeling on the day that the election is happening, to be there at the polls and to be able to cast that ballot. Obviously, so many people this year are going to vote by mail, and it is going to be, I mean, it's just something to watch because in all kinds of ways, we're seeing history happen right now.
Well, with all this discussion about voting, man, it'd be really helpful if we could actually talk to a voting official, a person who's actually responsible for carrying out an election. This is a little teaser for next week. Huh? Get excited. Is anybody else excited? I'm excited.
I'm excited, Brent.
Okay, thank you.
I'll be here for you.
Well, yeah, so just a little teaser. So next week on the ERLC podcast, we will be interviewing Tennessee's Secretary of State, Trey Hargett, who is he's a phenomenal person. He's a strong believer, and we thought it would make sense to maybe pose some of these questions about voting to someone who is actually in charge of conducting an election. So stay tuned for that next week. All right, moving on. ACB. So the confirmation of Amy Coney Barrett moves on Thursday of this week after a relatively low-key confirmation hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Judge Amy Coney Barrett's confirmation took the next step, the next procedural step, with a vote to advance her nomination to the floor of the full Senate. The nomination received a 12-0 vote out of the committee. 12-0. Now you might be remembering, wait, there's more senators than that serve on the Judiciary Committee. Well, you'd be right. Unfortunately, it was only Republicans who were voting on the record to proceed with her confirmation vote. Democrats did not participate in the vote. So we will be linking to a Baptist Press story on this development. And right now it looks like leader Mitch McConnell will be filing for cloture on this nomination, and there will be a full confirmation vote on Judge Barrett early next week.
Just for those who might not know, what is cloture?
Essentially, it means it is the procedural move to cut off debate.
There you go. Could be called closure, but instead it's called cloture, just to be confusing.
That's right. And just so you could provide us with that little snarky comment towards legislative procedural votes.
Well, Lindsay, interestingly enough, real-time fact check, it actually does come from the old French word that means closure. So your intuition is spot on.
Just natural intuition.
That's
so
right.
Proud
and
right
now we have closure on this portion of the podcast. All right. So this next story is a tad more serious. CNN is reporting on a hastily arranged news conference that took place midweek. Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe said Wednesday both Iran and Russia have obtained U.S. voter registration information in an effort to interfere in the election, including Iran posing as the far-right group Proud Boys to send intimidating emails to voters. Ratcliffe appeared alongside FBI Director Chris Wray, said that Iran was responsible for the email campaign, made it to look like it came from the Proud Boys, and was spreading disinformation about voter fraud through a video linked in some of the emails. Quote from Ratcliffe says this: "This data can be used by foreign actors to attempt to communicate false information to registered voters that they hope will cause confusion, sow chaos, and undermine your confidence in American democracy." So once again, we've got a presidential election that seems to have outside foreign actors attempting to manipulate or provide some sort of chaotic element here at the end of voting. This is certainly a concerning development.
I'm reading spy novels right now, and it sounds like something that would come out of a novel. And it's truly unbelievable that it's real life. It's that this kind of thing really happens.
It does. And I am thankful that we've got leaders and dedicated folks in the law enforcement arena that are constantly being vigilant for this sort of manipulation in our elections. So we do want to make sure that every American has confidence in this system and that it will produce a winner in this election. All right, so now moving over to the coronavirus front. This was a news report that we talked about around kind of the office, so to speak. COVID stress on marriage. Washington Post is reporting a major new survey of American families, the American Family Survey, found that 34% of married men and women ages 18 to 55 report the pandemic has increased stress in their marriage. I mean, look, that seems to be, you know, logically follows when we're all talking about how stressful these times are. Most married people in America report their unions, though, have gotten stronger, not weaker, in the wake of COVID-19. The survey found that 58% of married men and women, 18 to 55, said the pandemic has made them appreciate their spouse more, while 51% said their commitment to marriage had deepened. Only 8% said that the pandemic had weakened their commitment to one another. So in spite of breathless media reports of a surge, divorce actually appears to be down. It looks at initial data from 5 different states showing that finding. So I was really heartened and encouraged by this report.
That is really encouraging news. You know, one of my favorite things, I think I've mentioned this maybe in our COVID 6-month recap episode about the quarantine and stay at home orders and all that, is actually having my husband at home all the time. And I realize it's a unique time in our season of life when he's going to be able to be here at home. But it's been a blast. And I do wonder if some of this, these statistics and some of the ways people are responding is because they are together more. So they're getting to know one another again. They're spending time together again. Whereas before, in the rat race of life, people were going their own ways a lot of times, living separate lives and not knowing what's going on in each other's minds and hearts and on each other's schedules. So I love this report, Brent. I hope it continues past COVID, but it's really, really good news in the midst of a hard news season.
So yes, Lindsay, completely agree that this data is very encouraging for marriage. And like you, I hope that it continues well past this pandemic season. While we are on the topic of marriage, we would be remiss if we didn't mention the development that seemingly to me just kind of came out of left field this week from the Vatican. So Pope Francis decided to weigh in on same-sex civil unions. Baptist Press is reporting that in response to Pope Francis's endorsement of same-sex civil unions for the first time as Pope, Southern Baptist leaders reiterated their commitment to the authority of the Bible's teaching regarding sexuality and marriage. Pope Francis's endorsement came while being interviewed in the documentary Francesco, which premiered Wednesday at the Rome Film Festival. Here's the quote from the Pope. Quote, "Homosexual people have the right to be in a family. They are children of God," Francis said in an interview, as reported by the Associated Press. Picking up the quote from there, "You can't kick someone out of a family nor make their life miserable for this. What we have to have is a civil union law. That way they are legally covered." This went around the internet and certainly was talked about in Christian circles. And my sense was, the thing that struck me is, where does your kind of average Catholic believer wrestle with this? On the one hand, you've got the authoritative word of God, and where this is very plainly spelled out as marriage is between one man and one woman in a covenant relationship. And then on the other hand, now you have the Pope saying something that really undermines that. What do y'all think?
Well, I really like what Dr. Moore said in response to this. He said, he opened his comments by saying, "I'm not sure how to understand or to take what the Pope is saying here." And the response that I saw from a lot of faithful Catholics yesterday was basically one of trying to withhold judgment, to try to get more clarity, because obviously this was being reported based on comments he had made in this documentary or film. And so they just wanted to get more clarity based on what direction the Pope is actually trying to lead the church to endorse in terms of an official position. And so, you know, it is one where we would withhold judgment, I guess, because we know what the Word of God says. We know what we as Christians believe, and even, I mean, certainly what Catholics affirm about marriage. And so it's puzzling and potentially troubling, but it's one of those things that what we really want is more clarity.
Well, and this is a good reminder for us. as Christians to check where we look to for our authority on these matters. So are we looking to the culture? Are we listening to our own hearts or our own feelings, which can be misguided? Or are we looking to the authority of Scripture? And SBC President J.D. Greer, a friend and the real deal, he said, no matter what a pope, pastor, or elected official says, we do not get to define sexuality or the family. He went on to say, the Creator does, and on this, his word could not be more clear. And again, his word and the way that he defines sexuality in the family is the most loving thing. And it's what makes for our flourishing, whether in our fallen nature we feel that or not, or believe that or not. That is what is absolutely true.
Yeah, that was definitely a good word from Pastor Greer. So, all right, moving on to back to coronavirus. So this was interesting news that came out of Deseret News. Brain fog. That is a new term in this pandemic that I had not come across. Brain fog is a new symptom that has been seen in recovered COVID-19 patients. A doctor who is a neurologist at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, told a local news station that she has spoken with several patients about the condition in which people suffer from severe headaches and memory loss. Quote, oftentimes these patients may have even recovered from the initial fever and shortness of breath symptoms, and they continue to have very severe headaches and tend to often complain about memory loss, often referred to as a brain fog. The symptoms are similar to what people see during a concussion, she said. So one individual that is a close personal friend of mine who dealt with COVID-19, I don't know if he would describe what he went through as exactly brain fog, but he definitely had severe headaches, so much so that my wife Meredith and I were specifically praying for the Lord to relieve him of the effects of this very bad headache that he had for days on end. And I'll be interested now that I've kind of read this to go back to my friend and say, hey, do you think you've been experiencing brain fog as you were dealing with this?
Yeah, there's always something new that seems to be uncovered about coronavirus, whether it's a new symptom or something that you're going to talk about in just a minute, because I'm privy to the notes here on your culture rundown, Brent, or whether it's something that we thought was true and wasn't. But it's findings like this are the reason I am such a proponent of living your life, but being cautious and wise and living for the good of other people by wearing your masks and washing your hands and all of that. Because even if somebody survives COVID, sometimes we've seen that getting over it is hard. It's an uphill climb, and it lasts a long time. And you just never know who's going to be affected by it. And I've said that over and over and over again, but it's so true. And I don't want to lead someone to have to deal with brain fog. I have enough brain fog just from being in quarantine. So
I've got enough brain frog. See, brain frog.
You have frogs in your brain as well.
maybe brain frog, but I've got enough brain fog just because of my three young kids.
Yes.
There's a permanent state of brain fog, and that's called being a parent.
Yes.
All right. Well, actually, just taking off of what you said, still learning so much about this virus. So, you know, if you're like me, the early days of COVID-19, when you just didn't really know what was what, I remember going to the grocery store, coming back home, and like setting things down on the floor, wiping down everything with like a Clorox wipe. Well, Wired Magazine this week has a story about revisiting COVID-19 and surfaces. It's actually a pretty long, thorough report. In the story, they link to a number of different studies about surfaces. And this is something that is certainly on the mind of a number of pastors and church staff as they want to safely reopen. But basically, the long and short of it is we need to continue to take precautions, be sensible, but at the same time, we don't have to necessarily worry about bringing home items from the grocery store. Instead, we need to just make sure of if we know that we're in an area where there's a high probability of folks that may have the virus, be sensible in terms of wiping things down there. But things that are outside, things that are exposed to sunlight, probably in the clear there. So I thought that was a really good development. And we needed a good development because Axios is telling us that this week, New York reported the most coronaviruses since May. New York reported over 2,000 positive coronavirus cases on Wednesday of this week, the most infections seen in the state since May. So this is still very much out there. As colder weather gets in, a lot of analysts and scientists are saying, hey, we're beginning to enter a very hard season for COVID-19. Please, folks, be on the lookout, be safe, be sensible, be cautious, as Lindsay just wisely said, to make sure that we get through this season in the best shape possible. All right, back in Baptist life, Baptist Press is reporting that NAM, the North American Mission Board, is going to emphasize Hispanic church planning in the coming year, 2021. Over the course of the next decade, demographic projections estimate that the Hispanic population will increase by 30%, up from the 2016 figure of 57 million to 74 million people by 2030. In recognizing these demographic shifts, the North American Mission Board will emphasize Hispanic church planning beginning in 2021. I thought this was great. I mean, once again, NAM is kind of being light on its toes and wanting to make sure and be responsive to the ways that church planning can be encouraged and grow and be responsive to different communities that are out there around the country.
Yeah, I mean, that's been one of the really encouraging things that we've seen in SBC life in the last number of years. It's just our focus and the focus of the North American Mission Board on not only planting churches, but also planting churches to reach demographics that the Southern Baptist Convention has typically had a more difficult time ministering to. And so that includes a focus on Hispanic church plants and also African American churches. And I'm just encouraged by this continued positive trajectory.
Absolutely. All right. On the little bit of a lighter side, so the New York Times had this fascinating story this week, essentially about how a black hole in space eats. Astronomers call it the spaghettification of a star, and it's not a pretty idea. From the New York Times, it says, it's what happens when you venture too close to a black hole and fall in. Tidal forces stretch you and break you like a noodle. Then your shreds circle the black hole until they collide and knock each other in. On the upside, the energy released by your long fall and the crashing together of what used to be your atoms might produce a flash, a cosmic funeral pyre, if you will, that can be seen across the universe. So I'm going to talk about space in my lunchroom segment, but I thought this was just so absolutely neat because black holes are just something we don't really know that much about.
Well, I mentioned at the top of the show that Brent is, you know, into Christmas, and that's a weird thing about you is not heat, but Christmas. And this obsession with space is also another just interesting eccentricity of Brent Leatherwood. So thanks for sharing that with us.
You're welcome. Well, all right, and the wild ride with Brent concludes where it usually should, with baseball. So the World Series began this week after two really epic championship series in both the American League and the National League. The Dodgers, the Los Angeles Dodgers, who beat my beloved Atlanta Braves, it still hurts to really talk about it, are facing off against the Tampa Bay Rays for the World Championship in Major League Baseball. And I for one, am just so encouraged that we are coming down the stretch run here of the Major League Baseball season. I was very skeptical that we would actually be able to get through the baseball season, and we're almost there. And that's a good thing for America.
Well, here as of our recording, they played two games, and that's been fun to see. I've actually been watching it with family that we have in town. But my favorite part of watching is actually finding out what the players' nicknames are. So the pitcher at the beginning for the Rays, his nickname is Baby Giraffe. Would you feel validated if your nickname was Baby Giraffe?
Oh, me. All right. Well, so that's how we're wrapping it up. Brain fog, black holes, and baseball. So with that, Lindsay and Josh, that's your look at This Week in Culture.
now we're about to talk to our friend, Jennifer Marshall Patterson. She is the director of the Institute for Theology and Public Life at Reformed Theological Seminary, or RTS, in Washington, D.C., and she is also a senior visiting fellow with the Heritage Foundation. Jennifer, thanks so much for joining us today on the podcast, and we're excited to have you. As we're getting started, would you tell us just a little bit about yourself and what you do? And while you're at it, could you tell us one thing that God is teaching you in this season?
Well, thank you, Josh, and it's great to be with you guys. I appreciate this invitation. I have been living and working in Washington, D.C. for 25 years, with the exception of 1 year that I spent overseas teaching at a classical Christian school in France. But for the last quarter century, I've been here in Washington, D.C. That was after growing up in Wheaton, Illinois, and we spent some years on the mission field when I was age five to seven. My dad was a medical missionary, and we lived in Taiwan. So really wonderful to have those experiences as a young child and to grow up in a Christian home and have the opportunity to attend Wheaton College. I came out to Washington, D.C. thinking that I was going to be here for a 10-week internship, and I've ended up here 25 years plus later. So a little different than I thought the plan was going to be. And that's been the situation of my life as well with regard to marriage. I always looked forward to marriage and motherhood, and yet only got married 2 years ago, and I married a widower with two teen children, and so I'm also a step-parent, and God has brought a lot of change in this season. I have been working in public policy during my time in Washington, D.C., and recently stepped down from full-time work at that to finish up my PhD at the Catholic University of America in moral theology and ethics, and I'm right at the beginning of my dissertation phase with that. I'm also teaching and directing the Institute for Theology and Public Life at Reformed Theological Seminary here in Washington. So just a lot of opportunities that are great for reflecting on the intersection of theology and public life. And as to your question about one thing that God is teaching me in this season, I'm at the stage of embarking on my dissertation, and it's a very humbling experience. I'm reminded all the time that you don't know what you don't know, which is also a good lesson for other parts of life. I think just remembering to be a good listener, be a good reader, a close reader of Scripture, good listener to the people around us, that's a learning experience and a good and humbling opportunity.
Well, Jennifer, yes, that lesson is so helpful. And it was interesting to hear these little tidbits about your life that I didn't know about, living in France and your father being a medical missionary. It's always fascinating to hear how the Lord does not work as we planned, but that his plans are always better. So,
we're
just thankful for the ways that he's working in your life. So this podcast focuses on Christians and culture, and there's definitely no shortage of talking points in our current cultural climate. So can you tell us what things in culture that you and those around you have been paying closer attention to right now?
Well, this is the time of year when I turn my attention to an event that we've held at the Heritage Foundation for about the last 10 years, and it's we call it the Anti-Poverty Forum, looking at questions of poverty and community challenges that face the United States. And so it's an opportunity for me to look more deeply at what's going on, both in policy as well as in efforts at the community level to overcome challenges, help people pursue their aspirations, their dignity, and to overcome poverty and other social challenges. So right at this time of year, I'm particularly focused on looking at those issues. And after this very challenging year in so many ways, pandemic and protest and so many challenges that the world has faced, that our country has faced, we are looking at the principles and the practices that can help communities move forward together to overcome poverty, to overcome the challenges they're facing. And so I have the opportunity to interact with people like John Ponder, who runs the ministry Hope for Prisoners in Las Vegas and is now helping others across the country start similar things, helping those previously incarcerated to be able to restart their lives and to have mentoring to do that, and often the engagement of law enforcement in that mentoring process. So a ministry of reconciliation and a ministry of hope, as the title says. The Anti-Poverty Forum that we've hosted at the Heritage Foundation for the last decade gives us an opportunity to talk about our great examples in our culture like that, that are working to move forward.
Jennifer, that's great. And actually, that speaks to the various roles that you've had at the Heritage Foundation. You've served in a number of management roles there, and you also now direct the Institute of Theology and Public Life at Reform Theological Seminary there in D.C. So can you share with our audience some key leadership lessons that you've learned over the last few years?
Well, it's a great joy and privilege to work with a team and to work with individuals as they apply their gifts towards their calling, towards the pursuit of a cause and a mission, and to help them in that, to remove obstacles, to figure out how to solve challenges, help them see their gifts and how they can be furthered. It's a real joy and privilege to be able to do that. And part of that, I think, is the opportunity to strategize and identify what are the missing pieces? How can we make this work go further? How can we apply our gifts best to the challenge at hand? Much of that goes to accurately diagnosing the challenge. And with the culture changing so quickly around us on issues related to what it means to be human and understanding of marriage and sexuality and things like these, understanding and defining well what's happening is a large part of that challenge. So I think that strategic element is important to the leadership role, and as well, bringing together all those who are working towards a cause to work together to the greatest extent possible. Coalition building and consensus building, I think, is an important part of the role of a leader. And then finally, having expectations that are rigorous and high for oneself and for the team as a whole, being accountable and pursuing with excellence the tasks that are set before us for the good of our neighbor and for the glory of God.
Yeah, thank you for those lessons, Jennifer. And you've certainly lived those out as we've watched you in your different roles. So living in D.C. over the last 25 years, I'm sure that you are no stranger to the focus on politics leading up to the election. But as Christians, we know that our role as citizens doesn't begin and end on election day. So do you have any advice for Christians as they think about engaging the public square after November 3rd?
There is such a temptation, I think, in the world of 24/7 cable news and just massive information flow that goes on around us to be tempted to look at politics as a spectator sport, with all that goes with that, you know, the dynamics of us versus them and a sense of being distanced from it and not really engaged and just watching it unfold. And that's particularly true in an election season, perhaps particularly true in this year of 2020. So it's important, I think, that we realize in season and out that politics, government is just one of the ways that we think about how to organize together, organize life together in a political community. It's not the only way, but it's an important way that we answer the question, what's worth pursuing as a society? What problems do we need to solve? So the political, the elections, legislative process, legal process, judicial, and so on, they're one avenue through which we address these questions, but not the only way. And the government is interacting with other arenas in society, how we approach life in the family, in the church, in business, in all the many activities of civil society. These are also places that we deal with questions about how are we going to live together in community? What do we want to aspire to? What do we want to rule out as something that is not good, and we should not be pursuing that? These are questions that we wrestle with in all these arenas of life, and I think it's critically important for us to remember our roles and our various callings across those domains, so that our personal life in the family, the way we engage in our church, the way we engage in our workplace, our contributions to thinking about our overall life as a community and important ways that we answer problems and challenges that we face as a society. That means that how a church goes about mercy ministry, how it welcomes those who are visiting, how it lives in community with its neighbors, all those are ways that questions in society get answered. And we should invest ourselves in those to find answers for society. Those are part of answering questions and challenges that are facing society. So as we see our culture really wrestling with questions of what it means to be human, what's the nature and purpose of a person, these are the kinds of questions in particular that the church, that ministries can help our communities reflect on in a deeper way, in a fuller way, in a way that is true to the testimony of what Scripture tells us about being made in the image of God. So there's a lot of contribution that individuals can make by their leadership in their family, by their contribution to their church, by their conduct in the workplace, by their engagement in so many other activities in life, as well as engaging as citizens in the political process. All of these are parts of answering the great challenges of our day, and a Christian worldview brings a light, particularly in our era, I think, as to what it means to be human and those questions that are being asked, the longings of the human heart for things that are eluding much of our political discourse today. Christian worldview has a lot to teach about those.
I like that. I like that a lot, Jennifer. And another thing I liked in your response is you talked about these kind of issues that we wrestle with. And look, there's a number of folks in our audience that are wrestling with different things as it relates to kind of a season of singleness. And so you wrote a book titled Now and Not Yet, Making Sense of Single Life in the 21st Century. Well, now you're married. What lessons in singleness are particularly poignant to you now that you are in a different season?
Well, I appreciate that question. And I think it was the fact that I had housemates as a single person was good practice and preparation for married life, living in a family. And that means being intentional about community, even when it's not the most convenient thing or, you know, you'd rather do it your way, there's a give and take to a household life. The other interesting thing about married life is, as I said, I married a widower, and our experiences of single life had been different. So I had been single my entire adult life. He had been married previously since college and then single for several years as a widower before I met him. That puts a different perspective on the experience of singleness. And particularly as we're all aging and we'll have different experiences as we go through life, and the realities of singleness are different at different stages of life. This has been a good reminder to me of thinking about the seasons of life as they change. And really what I was trying to get across in my book, Now and Not Yet, was the fact that seasons do change, and in unexpected ways that we cannot control. Our way of making sense of that is to pursue our highest call to glorify and enjoy God here and now in the season to which He's called us, the circumstances in which He's placed us, and continue to have those desires and longing of the heart for something more when it is His good will to grant that to us, or to maintain that sense of longing if it isn't something that's going to come along. So a recognition of how to live contentedly and with a sense of fullness of life, even when there's an experience of longing for something more, that tension is going to be experienced in different ways at different seasons of life, but it's an almost perennial, I think, experience of how we go through life. And as things change around us, we have a longing that's unmet. How are we going to deal with that? And I think scripture gives us the resources for that. I was really trying to mine those resources, apply it to single life, but really it applies to all the seasons of our lives and all the changes. And particularly in this pandemic year where no one could have expected the ways that our lives would change, that's an important message from scripture for us.
Gosh, Jennifer, we want to say thanks so much for joining us today. And you bring such a distinctly Christian approach to each of those topics and areas. And so we're grateful for you and for your partnership with us at the ERLC. And we just want to say thanks so much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you very much.
So now it's time for the Lunchroom, where every week we tell you about the things we've been talking about with one another. Lindsay, you're up first this week, so tell us what's on your mind.
Okay, so two things. First off, I wanted to make sure to highlight that our guest from last week, and Benjamin Watson and his wife, Kirsten, they just started a parenting podcast, which if you listened last week, you know that they have seven kids, which includes twins at the very end there. And so I think they are probably qualified to be talking a little bit about parenting right now. So they discuss things like election season with your kids, pregnancy and newborns, keeping the spark in your love story. It just began, so there's only a couple episodes, but I would encourage you to listen to it and to glean from their wisdom. They're just such a solid couple. I'm so encouraged that the Lord has raised up their voices as believers here in the midst of our society. And then this other one that I have is just something funny. My husband is involved in the music industry and songs and songwriting. And his brother, who is actually 18 years younger than him, is a songwriter. And so anytime they get together, they talk about songs and different things like that. Well, the other day, his brother was sharing this song that it's from 2018. I had no idea. It was a country song that was actually a joke, but it became popular. And this guy who was on The Voice was like, let's write a song that just says the same thing over and over again. So have y'all heard this? It's called Parked Out by the Lake. It's hilarious. This is what the song says. I'm still parked out by the lake, 80 miles from Santa Fe, and I'm sitting here just parked out by the lake. If you're wondering where I parked, I'm out parked by the lake. It's the lake that's 80 miles from Santa Fe. And then the chorus is, and I'm parked out by the lake, 80 miles from Santa Fe. It's the lake that's parked where I'm at, out by the lake. And this lake is where I'm parked, 80 miles from Santa Fe. And I'm still parked out here by this lake, 80 miles from Santa Fe.
It has a Dr. Seussian kind of vibe to it.
It is hilarious. And then breaking news, Megan said via, what's this called that you text? Via text.
That brain frog.
That Bobby Bones, the syndicated country radio personality, had him on his show and then he became famous. So it cracks me up. You should go listen to the song because it's hilarious.
That's a quintessential lunchroom. I mean, that is the definition of a totally useless topic of conversation. So thanks for bringing that into our lives.
And for I bet what you're talking about is useless too, Josh. So,
you know, I'll take the blame. I mean, last week I did talk about real lightsabers, but this week I'm going to talk about something that I actually think is really great. So TGC published a piece by a church planter named Cameron Triggs. I think he's a church planter down in Florida. And the piece was called "The Ballot Booth Is Not Your Baptism." And it was there have been a series of really helpful articles related to the election, think about voting. And this one in particular, I found to be just really, really helpful because this is a topic of conversation amongst so many Christians. And so just kind of talking you through a couple of the headings here. I mean, the first thing he says is you're likely not an expert. So it's interesting that we get into such like vehement debates about politics with relatives and friends and even strangers. And we should all have enough humility to acknowledge that we don't know everything, and few of us are actually really, really studied in or experienced in the world of politics. And then he also points out that no candidate is perfect. All of us are wrestling with imperfect decisions and imperfect people trying to make the best decisions that we can. He reminds us that neither party is the Christian party, which I think sometimes we tend to forget. He talks about the fact that politicians don't always keep their promises. But most importantly, he talks about the fact that it is not an issue for the church that we have a diversity of political opinions and views in the body of Christ. That is in no way a sign that the church is weak or that something is wrong with our understanding of the gospel. And so I would encourage you to read this as you're thinking through it, because one of the most important things that, or one of the main things that I'm praying for coming out of election season is for a sense of unity in the church, not just in the church broadly, but even in our own local churches, that we would experience real unity, regardless of the outcome of the election or who it was that you happened to vote for.
It's a word to the wise, man. All right, so for my lunchroom segment this week, I'm talking about asteroids.
Take us to outer space, Brent.
We're going where no man has gone before. We're talking about asteroids, the Orionids, and space with my daughters. Okay, so there was a true scientific achievement that took place this week by NASA. A NASA spacecraft unfurled its robotic arm on Tuesday, and at a first for the agency, briefly touched an asteroid to collect dust and pebbles from the surface of it to be delivered back to Earth in 2023. The well-preserved ancient asteroid known as Bennu is currently more than 200 million miles from Earth, and it offers scientists a window into the early solar system. So obviously, that's just fascinating. We're actually able to do what those movies about, what one was what, Deep Impact, and the other was Bruce Willis. Was it Armageddon?
Armageddon.
Yeah, that's right. Bruce Willis, Ben Affleck, they're going to save us. But they, you know, in the movie, they touch down ships onto the surface of an asteroid. And well, here we are actually doing it. We just don't have Ben Affleck, because he's not busy playing Batman anymore. He was the worst Batman, by the way. All right. Then
that's
moving on.
Brent.
Yeah, it is. Then the other thing I mentioned. So the Orionids. So this is the name of the shooting stars that occur each year around this time of the year. And so this week my daughter came home and she's like, hey, my teacher started talking about this and I had no idea about it. So I hopped online and started looking for it. And I said, well, if your teacher wants you to really see it, we're going to have to wake up really early the next morning because that's when it will be at its peak. My other daughter overheard us and they both are like, wake us up. We want to see it. So I feel like I win kind of like Dad of the Month award, because I woke up my kids early, 4:45 in the morning. We went outside. I put big blankets on them and we went out on our back deck and looked up into the sky. And lo and behold, we saw Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, not necessarily in that order. And we saw a couple of satellites, and then we saw these comets. And honestly, it was probably one of the best mornings that I've had as a dad. We just made some sweet memories just talking about space, and they thought it was so cool. So there you go. That's my lunchroom segment for the week.
I'm sure they'll remember that for a long time too. Did you see anything get spaghettified?
No, I really wanted to see something get spaghettified, but apparently you need like a very powerful telescope to see something get spaghettified. But hey, that's a life goal, right?
Yeah, I told Brent when he was sharing this experience with me that he had basically checked the box for all of the dad goals for a month. And honestly, Brent, it might be more than a month. I mean, that is, you banked up some serious capital in your I'm a good dad column. So just want to commend you for that. Sounds really awesome.
Thank you for that affirmation, Joshua Wesley.
Absolutely, man. So that's going to do it for the show this week. Just as a reminder, you can find links to all the things that we talked about today in the show notes. And if you like the podcast, please consider helping us spread the word by sharing this episode on social media or going into your podcast app and leaving us a rating or review. Thanks so much for listening. And for Brent, Lindsay, and myself, we will be back next week with more content.